Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen Episode 109, The Secret Subway. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and we are very pleased to have here today as our guest, Matthew Algio. He is the author of New York Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach, and The Origins of Mass Transit. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Well, I am both a civic infrastructure architecture and a mass transit fan, so when I saw this come across the scanner, I knew I had to talk to you.
It ticks all the boxes, I guess.
It really does. And it also ticks another box that we frequently happen upon in its intersection with the built environment, which, of course, is public corruption and mismanagement. And there's quite a bit of that going on in this story as well. So as a little bit of a background, essentially, there was a very short demonstration subway built under Broadway in New York City in the late 1860s, operating into the early 1870s, by an inventor named Alfred Beach, who was also, at one point, the owner and co-editor, I believe, of Scientific American. So this is a a bona fide American inventor who kept company with people like Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell and pretty much everyone else worth noting from this Gilded Era period of invention that gave us the modern world. One thing we don't have very much of these days, despite promises to the contrary by current inventor aspirants that shall remain nameless, is a pneumatic tube underground system, but we almost had one in the 1860s. So take us back, Matt. What were the circumstances under which Alfred Beach was working, and why did he think that a pneumatic tube subway was the way to go?
It's really hard for us to appreciate just how congested Manhattan was at the time. We're talking again 1860s, late 1860s. The streets were a literal mess. 10,000 horses were employed pulling stagecoaches, which they called omnibuses, but that they were basically glorified stagecoaches, and horse-pulled streetcars. Those were the only two forms of public transportation that were available to people in the late 1860s in New York. And the streets were utter chaos, with thousands of private wagons, delivery wagons, vendors selling everything from oysters to corn on the cob to day-old bread, beggars and pickpockets. I mean, just crossing the street, literally crossing Broadway near City Hall, could take 15 minutes before you found a suitable break in the traffic, and even then you were risking your life. Police would have to escort people across Broadway, women and children. They just couldn't do it by themselves. The existing forms of public transportation that I mentioned, the omnibus and the streetcar, they were crowded, they were filthy, they were steaming hot in the summer and freezing cold in the winter. They were uncomfortable, and they were very slow because they were limited to the speed that the other traffic could go on the streets. And on Broadway, you're talking at peak hours, might be 2 miles an hour. I mean, it would be faster to walk if you could walk, but it was so crowded you couldn't walk at a normal pace, which is about 4 miles an hour. So Alfred Beach, he was born into some money. His father owned the New York Sun. As you mentioned, he bought the Scientific American magazine in 1845. It had only been founded a year before. And he and his friend Oscar Munn would control Scientific American magazine really for the rest of the 19th century. He was a commuter. Beach was a commuter. He lived in Brooklyn first, and then he lived a little farther uptown in Manhattan. It was only a couple miles, but again, it was a trip that could take 45 minutes or an hour. And he knew there had to be a solution to the public transportation problem in New York. London had opened an underground in 1863, so there was an underground railroad. There was a subway in existence at the time. Beach, of course, was aware of this. In fact, probably saw it. He would travel to Europe. and he knew it would be a good solution in New York. But there was a problem with the Underground Railroad in London. The subway was powered by a steam locomotive. Well, in tunnels, this was not the best mode of transportation because of the cinders and the steam and the smoke that the steam locomotive would emit. And this actually got a lot of people in the London subway sick because of the smoke-filled tunnels. And so Beach was aware that there were experiments going on in London at the time with pneumatic power. There was a pneumatic tube mail system that was put in place that would carry mail from the train stations to the central post office in London. And this proved to be much faster than over the ground delivery, which again, London's traffic was as bad as New York's. And so there was the pneumatic dispatch, it was called, was installed in London in the late 1860s, and it carried packages and bags of mail from the, as I mentioned, from the train stations to the central post office. So Beach had the idea to scale this up, basically. He was going to build a pneumatic tube system that would carry people instead of packages. And so that's what he set out to do, but he had a lot of obstacles to overcome to make that happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the biggest ones, of course, is sort of the villain of the book, Boss Tweed, who ran Tammany Hall, the New York political machine. Can you talk a bit about the political milieu and where Tweed fits into this? Because, I mean, the late 1860s is a few years after the Civil War and the New York City draft riots and the rise of that political machine, the so-called Great Barbecue era. For our listeners' sake, who was Tweed, and in what milieu was Beach trying to build this in terms of entrenched political and financial interests?
Boss Tweed, William M. Tweed, was the undisputed political leader of New York, although he was never mayor, which I have to admit, when I went into this, I didn't always assume Boss Tweed was mayor. He was never mayor.
He has a courthouse, but he isn't mayor.
Right, yeah. Right. He kept his fingers in a lot of different pies. He was a state senator. He was on the city streets commission, public works commission. He was a city alderman. He was an assistant alderman. So he held a lot of different positions. He was on the education committee, but his effectiveness was really behind the scenes and guiding legislation and controlling legislation both at the municipal level and at the state level. Tammany Hall, of course, was the great political machine of the time. Tweed was able to win the loyalty of Irish immigrant voters, especially, and they returned the favor by voting for his candidates pretty much uniformly. And of course, there was a touch of fraud involved. Tweed would famously have hundreds of Irish immigrants sworn in as U.S. citizens days before an election, get them registered and get them to vote. There would be stories of groups of voters who would just go from polling place to polling place, casting multiple votes on a single day. Tweed's rackets were pretty straightforward. The courthouse you mentioned was really one of the great boondoggles in American history. I think it cost twice as much as the purchase of Alaska. I think Alaska cost $7 million. The courthouse cost $14 million. But what he would do is he would award these contracts to people for ridiculously inflated prices. They would do the work and then kick back half of the money to Tweed and his cronies. For instance, there was a plasterer that got paid $10,000 a day, which you can imagine in 1868 or 1869 was an absolutely fantastic sum. I mean, basically, they were driving New York City into bankruptcy with the corruption. The thing that affected Beach most directly was, well, there were two things, actually. One was that the streetcar operators and the horse car operators basically paid protection money to Tweed to make sure no competitors would spring up. Tweed would kill any charter that came up in the state legislature that would allow anyone to build a competing form of public transportation. And so it killed all competition. And the second, Tweed was directly involved. Tweed was on the board of at least one streetcar company, so the interest was even direct. And so Tweed was able to kill any proposal that came up to improve public transportation in New York. And there were proposals. I mean, there were some great ideas, some kooky ideas. The perpetual moving sidewalk. I love that idea. Build an elevated sidewalk that moved at 10 miles an hour. There was the arcade plan, which was basically to dig out Broadway, build a second Broadway underneath Broadway, where all the transportation, public transportation could be. And then above, you could have a space for pedestrians and private vehicles. Elevated Railroad in 1867-68 was constructed on Greenwich Street. So there were all these ideas, but Tweed, at the peak of his power, and we're talking 1869, 1870, he's absolutely at the peak of his power, was able to kill almost all these ideas.
Yeah, that's a fascinating interaction there. And he did actually have, Tweed did have his own constituency that was interested in building a different railway, but it was one that would be extremely disruptive to the urban fabric, much more so than a tunnel would have been. And it involved a lot of property takings that seemed to go back into his pockets.
So this was Tweed's idea, because Tweed knew, okay, the clamor for an improvement in public transportation was so great that even Tammany Hall could not ignore it. So Tweed kind of maneuvered himself to the front of the parade and came up with this idea to build a viaduct railway on a giant stone arches that would cut through huge swaths of the city and have four tracks for steam locomotive trains that would run the length of the city. It would have been like a giant scar across the city. Thousands of buildings would have had to have been destroyed. And of course, Tweed had it set up so he was on the board of directors, and all the money that the state would pay for this would be funneled through Tweed, and Tweed would get to award all the contracts. I mean, it really would have made the courthouse look like minor league stuff compared to what he envisioned for this viaduct railroad that would split the city quite literally in two. So he had his own idea. Tweed knew something had to be done, and if that something had to be done, Tweed would be involved in it.
So while we're talking about the boss here, I've got to ask, on page 140, Freudian slip?
There is a typo.
Or a typo.
It is a Freudian slip. It is a Freudian slip.
May I read the sentence?
It somehow is, you may.
I did discover a connection between Beach and Trump in my research, and it might shed light on Tweed's abrupt about-face. So what's the context there?
Somehow Trump replaced Tweed. It somehow escaped me, the editor, the proofreader, and the indexer. And then, of course, as soon as it came out, I started getting emails from people saying, did you mean to say Trump? And no, I did not mean to say Trump. Now, I will say there was a section in there that kind of explicitly compared Trump to Boss Tweed, but that ended up getting cut from the final manuscript. But somehow his name had insinuated itself into my head and then onto the pages of my
book. And that's just the most convenient one, regret. Of course. I mean, you could have just as easily put Adams.
or Moses, or any of these. It's interesting, these figures, of course, who play behind the scenes. Of course, the difference between Tweed and Trump is that Tweed could win elections in New York, unlike Trump.
Right, right.
But getting back to Beach, so I guess at the backdrop here, so he has seen the London example. He deals firsthand every day with the problem of epic congestion and horse droppings and things. So how does he procure the site? Where does he begin into this here? I guess take us forward here in terms of how Beach begins to construct the secret subway and his pneumatic system and his partners.
Yeah. He needed a cover story. And I mentioned earlier that there was a successful pneumatic tube system for moving mail in London. And so what Beach did is he went to the legislature. Tweed was a state senator at the time. And he wanted a charter not to carry passengers, but to build small tubes to move mail. It would be an experimental system, and he would do that, and then he would get the approval of the postmaster to extend the mail delivery system all over the city. And so my theory is, and I think it's Beach all but admitted it, that it was a cover story to allow him to start digging a tunnel under Broadway without raising too much notice. So he was able to get a charter in the legislature in 1870 that he wanted the charter to do the pneumatic tube system for mail. And he had the charter worded in such a way that it was almost impossible for anyone to inspect it. Beach's brother, Moses, had been a state lawmaker, and Beach himself knew his way around Albany, and he kind of worded this charter so expertly that it was almost impossible to inspect what he was up to down there. And so he began building the tunnel in 1869. And he claims that, you know, after he saw that he was going to enclose two smaller tubes inside a larger tube, and then when he had to excavate the larger tube, he said, well, gee, this is 8 feet in diameter. We could fit a passenger train in here, and the need for a passenger train is so much greater than the need for moving freight in New York right now. Why don't I just go ahead and build a passenger train? And so he used this charter to build a mail tube as a way to go ahead and build the passenger tube without getting too much notice. Now, he built it very luxuriously, and he had a luxurious waiting room. So when he started lowering grand pianos down into the basement there, people started to wonder what was really going on. But he was able to do it more or less unnoticed. In, I think it was something like 2 months, they were able to dig a 300-foot-long tunnel under Broadway from Warren down to Murray Street. And again, it was just an experimental line. It was just a proof of concept. He wanted to show that it would work. But he was able to do that. He designed a tunneling shield especially for the project that was able to excavate rather quickly and efficiently. And of course, he designed the car itself and the layout for the station. So yeah, he was able to get a good cover story that enabled him to do this thing in secret, which just sounds preposterous. But at the time, and again, there's so much chaos going on in Lower Manhattan at the time with the general congestion and mayhem on the streets, that I guess seeing this taking place, you know, didn't raise much interest, much curiosity.
It does kind of sound like it was very much accepted and embraced once people actually took the trouble to experience it. Like, it didn't sound like, unlike a lot of other early inventions, you know, that were coming sort of really fast a pace at that time. You know, the story of people running out of Lumiere's movie theater because they thought the train would hit them. You know, there wasn't that kind of apprehension about it. It seemed like people were very comfortable with it. Do you think that the approach that he took with trying to bring in sort of urban sophisticates and wealthy people in, as his first customers, had a lot to do with that? Or like priming their experience by giving them basically like a first class lounge experience,
The fact that Beach invented the lounge, you know, given the New Yorker just wrote its big piece about airport lounges, and like, yes, the lounge precedes mass transit even, is a very hilarious outcome.
Right, right. He wanted to make it first class all the way. And that was to appeal to the higher class and the political class. So he opens it in February of 1870. He has a special invitation-only event where he invites politicians and the press. And they are completely blown away by this thing, this waiting room with a fountain with goldfish and plush settees along the wall and paintings. And there's a ladies' lounge even, and of course the piano. And then the experience of riding the carriage itself. He basically just had a huge fan that blew this cylindrical, you know, tube-shaped carriage down the tunnel. And then you reverse the fan and it sucked it back. But compared to what was available for public transportation at the time, it was sparkling clean. It was comfortable. It was climate controlled. They were 20 feet underground, didn't have to worry about heat or cold. There was no horse poop, of which there were tons dropped on the street every day. There were no smoke and cinders from a locomotive pulling the carriage because the engine was stationary. And so you're right. He made it almost irresistible to people, especially when in comparison to what they were experiencing above ground. And of course, it's nothing like what the subway is in New York today. We don't have goldfish fountains in the, unfortunately.
Although,
be nice if we did.
Although that said, it is interesting. I had the fortune of being at the opening of the Second Avenue subway line on New Year's Eve 2017. And there I can imagine a similar scene where we oohed and aahed at the Chuck Close murals with the incredible art budgets given the cost overruns. But there was Cuomo at the peak of his powers with all of his cronies and all of his supporters there. So history does rhyme a little bit in that regard.
And it's often you see, like right at the beginning of these services, of course, it's the it's kind of the peak, right?
This is as good as a subway smell.
Exactly. You don't get that much. And so Beach really took care of that. Now, I will say there was a lot of apprehension about technological advances at the time, like you mentioned. One of my favorites is the phonograph recording human voices. The idea that the human voice could live on after somebody died really freaked people out. And there was some apprehension about the subway just in that getting people to go underground to ride in these opaque tubes took some doing. This was one reason Beach painted the tunnel white. The tunnel was illuminated so it wouldn't be pitch black as you rode through it. And there was also, you know, the psychological aspect of the underground being the place of death. It's where you put bodies. It's where hell was, that sort of thing. So I think Beach was cognizant of that and really was able to overcome that with the way he designed the project.
Just thinking more about how this compares to what ultimately got built, and which was the foundation of the subway system that exists today. It's interesting because I remember the sort of public dialogue as the Interboro Rapid Transit was being proposed and developed, which was also a private company. They all were private companies until consolidation after World War II. But I remember some newspaper blaring a headline or a statement saying, New Yorkers will never want to emerge from a hole in the ground. You know, this is just unthinkable. And I wonder how much, you know, of that was driven by whatever the attendant politics were at that time, or whether that was really the public sentiment. Because at that point, the London Underground had been around for a while. The Paris Metro was already under construction, if not operating. So was it such a foreign concept, especially the publicity that the Beach subway then got, you know what I mean? And people, I just wonder if that was sort of a made-up outrage.
I think it was fear-mongering. I think that would probably be one way to describe it, and it was promoted by the people who opposed the construction of a subway. Now, we mentioned Boss Tweed a lot. There was another guy we should mention, Alexander T. Stewart, and he owned a huge department store on Broadway, one of the richest Americans who ever lived. Even today, adjusted for inflation and everything, it's like the eighth richest American who ever lived. And he opposed any improvement in public transportation, especially on Broadway, because he was afraid it would take people off the street. And he wanted people walking by his store and seeing in the great display windows and being drawn inside the store. So he was opposed unalterably to any change in the status quo as far as public transportation on Broadway. So he was one of the people. He was convinced, first of all, he kept saying the buildings will collapse. And of course, the buildings weren't going to collapse. And at one point, he intimated that by excavating a tunnel, it might cause a cholera outbreak, that diseases would be exposed if they dig this tunnel. So I think you're right that the actual fear that people had about riding through a tunnel, there was definitely some, but it was exaggerated for purposes of keeping the thing from being built.
Yeah, it's so interesting too, because you think of today where, you know, a merchant or a downtown property owner would be delighted to have a subway coming directly to his door because that would mean traffic.
Would they? I see this. I can see the parallels and debates over bike lanes, et cetera, there too. You know, it's just a fascinating portrait of this time where, like, yeah, where foot traffic was everything, and there was maximum congestion of the street plane, separate before cars. That's what I find the most fascinating part about this story is that it just precedes the creation of the New York City subway and the later dramas that followed with, you know, George Steinway, I believe it was Steinway, building his own private tunnels and the things that would follow from here. It's like a dress rehearsal, it feels, in many ways. Well, Matt, in that regard, I mean, what do you think are the actual lessons that can applicability to today, given the massive cost overruns of the Second Avenue subway and America's sort of post-eventimentalism and the abundance movement and all these sorts of things? I'm curious, like, where can we actually find lessons, I guess, out of this?
I guess the big lesson is that there is no new lesson here. That it's been this way for 150 years or 200 years. That any major public works proposal will always face opposition, political opposition. I guess the one thing I think of compared to today, you know, Beach financed this all himself. This was all privately financed, and you mentioned that the subway companies were all private companies originally, and so. It's just interesting that a guy with his own money, and I think he spent $300,000 or $400,000 on it, which is a lot of money in 1869. But, you know, Alexander T. Stewart could have easily built his own private subway if he had wanted to. So I think one of the things that has changed is the way these large projects are financed. One of the things that killed the Beach Line was that when he finally got permission to do it, there was an economic panic. There's always a panic in the 1900s. There's with the, or the 1800s, the 19th century. There's the panic of 1873, and of course, even though Tweed has been deposed, Beach could not get financing for his project. So, really, I think in the Beach Pneumatic Railway, we see a lot of the things that we still see today. And in some ways, you wonder, well, why haven't we fixed any of these problems in the past 150 years, right? It's like, but it is as it was.
Well, it's also interesting. I'm remembering now, because I think they came later with electrification, which this again precedes, was the traction monopolies in Seattle and elsewhere, where my friend Anthony Townsend in his book Ghost Road about autonomous vehicles draws those parallels there, where electrification, energy, mobility nexus, and those kinds of entrenched interests. It always seems like if there's a privatization of public transport, various competing financial interests get involved to wrangle it, that there's never a coordination of the system. So yeah, I don't know if the parallels come out of that as well.
I think what's interesting is in that regard too, is that Beach was really kind of he was ahead of his time. I mean, the subway didn't get built for another 30 years, but electrification, which really came about maybe 10 years later, I think 1881, Siemens invented one of the first electric motors that, and he did, you know, powered it through one of the rails. The problems that Beach was attempting to solve as far as cleanliness ease of and efficiency of movement were solved by electrification, by that system. I always think if Beach had been able to successfully build out the pneumatic tube system in New York in the early 70s, they probably would have converted it to electric propulsion in the 1880s, but it would have been a really good head start. But yeah, you're right, in terms of sort of consolidating. There is a point in the book where I talk about Tweed and in fact, it's where the Trump typo is, where Tweed and Beach kind of were doing back channel negotiations. Maybe they could reach some sort of agreement. And I wonder if something had happened along those lines, how differently things would have worked out. I think Beach in the end chose to kind of take on the power structure rather than work with the power structure, which was a political decision and maybe pragmatic as well. But yeah, if he had instead got everybody on board, maybe it would have worked.
Well, the other obvious historical echo, and sort of they pair together, interestingly enough, too, if Trump, we see Trump as a Tweedian analog, then obviously the analog of Beach today would be Elon Musk, and of course, Hyperloop and the Boring Company. And I'm curious your thoughts on those, because that began almost a pneumatic tube or similar in its vacuumness. But again, at different grades, privatized infrastructure. And of course, I think Musk has finally more or less admitted, given what we already knew, but in his comments about public transport, that it was a way to basically sabotage California high-speed rail. So I'm curious your thoughts on how that saga rhymes historically, too.
I'm reluctant to compare Alfred Beach to Elon Musk. I think Beach was much better intentioned than Elon Musk. I think Beach's proposal was much more practical and realistic. I think Elon comes up with big ideas. Implementation seems to be a problem. Beach was much more practical. He himself invented the tunneling shield to help build the thing. I like the idea of the Hyperloop. You know, there are, of course, magnetic maglev trains now in operation that remind me kind of what Beach was looking to do, basically make a car with so little friction that you could move it with air. I think Beach was really ahead of his time, and I think he really he believed in what he was doing, and I don't think he was a charlatan, even though it was kind of a crazy idea. And I think Elon Musk isn't all those things. But I would love, I mean, Beach envisioned the country being crisscrossed with tubes that would shoot you from New York to San Francisco. And, you know, when you see some of the speeds that the high-speed, you know, the bullet trains in Japan achieve these days, you kind of be like, boy, that would be cool. That would be cool if you could get in a tube and just be shot across the country.
Even as a practicality of the urban mass transit, though, I think you're probably right in your inference that had this been built at any kind of scale, it probably would still have been transferred over to electric traction, because that's what the elevated railways were already doing, and they were connected directly and sometimes were interline operating with the subways. But I do wonder if that critical sort of ramp-up period might have created some of the things that we are only now clamoring for, because the physical environment of the subway is so intolerable, you know, with the heat being thrown off from the air conditioning systems. You know, the New York system famously doesn't have platform screen doors, which is also a major safety issue. That, you know, a lot of newer systems in Europe and Asia have obviated by building that from the beginning. But I wonder if the need to create a vacuum connection that was continuous, and if this were to be scaled up, do you think they would have done stuff like platform screen doors, and that would have been considered acceptable, the only acceptable way to build public transit? And so even if the motive power was changed, that amenities like that would have remained.
Yeah, well, just looking at the idea of the waiting room is something that fascinates me to think about, that if he had actually built those kinds of spaces for the length of the line, just how cool that would have been, right? You know, you would have had these luxurious stations at each stop. One of the advantages of the tube that's probably worth mentioning is that you could never have a collision inside it, right? Because you'd have the tube could only go one way at a time, and of course the air pressure would always keep the cars apart. This was something else that Beach was very conscious of. There were a lot of train accidents at the time. You know, every week there would be another train accident. I think I mentioned in the book, like, when the charter for one of these went up, there was a train derailment in England that almost killed a Charles Dickens. You know, I mean, celebrities getting hurt in train crashes and things. So I think Beach really wanted to push that notion too, that this was a much safer form of transportation. He had a really cool idea that instead of having a fan at every station that you could alternate stations, and the fan could suck the car from the previous station and then blow it to the next station, and then the next station wouldn't need it. Another idea he had was you could actually just have one fan for long stretches. When you got to the station, you could slightly expand the tube, and that would give enough space for the air to pass by the car. You could stop the car with a brake, and then the car, when you release the brake, there would be enough pressure to push the car back into the closed tube and go to the next station. So all kinds of different ideas that he had for how this system would look. I have a map in the book of the proposed route, which just sort of comes from newspaper accounts at the time and interviews that he gave. I'm getting away from the original question, but I guess the answer is we just don't know, like, how exactly Beach would have made the thing look.
It's fascinating. It's interesting that you did, you know, subtitle it with Origins of the Mass Transit, because it definitely sounds like it was pitched, you know, toward the city elites. And if he had sort of created that standard of service, do you think that his vision was that there would eventually be, I don't know, first and second class coaches or some other way of accommodating, you know, the people who were the vast majority of the omnibus passengers and people walking on the streets?
That's a good question. Yeah. So you could create classes of passengers, which is what they did on the railroad cars. And I think even on the early subways in London, you could buy first class or second class tickets. And the other question is, what would he have charged exactly? So when he finally won the charter, I think at one point he was intent on charging a higher fare than the omnibuses and the streetcars charged. When he finally did win the charter, and he did win a charter, Beach was deposed in 1871, and then I think in 1872, Beach got a charter passed. The governor then, at the time, John Adams Dix, insisted that he reduce the fares during the morning and the evening rush hours so the working man, quote unquote, would be able to use it. So I think Beach's first vision for it was to have either a two-class system or to even make it something that would pull the richer riders off of the omnibuses and streetcars. But then as the way the charter was worded at the end, he, at least during the rush hours, would have to have a fare that was kind of comparable to what the omnibuses and the streetcars charge. So, yeah, it's one of those things we don't know how would this have played out. Would it have become sort of like the high-class way to get uptown and only the rich people could afford to pay a quarter to ride uptown? Or would it have become a true mass transit? I think Beach envisioned it as mass transit, but also he wanted to make money.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely set up and very appropriately so through most of the book as a sort of a battle of wills between Beach and Tweed. But in the end, you know, Beach outlasted Tweed as a viable entity. It sounds like it was actually the panic of 1873 that killed the financing for the project. Or does that sound like the final nail in the coffin?
Yeah, it's funny though. Tweed, even after he was overthrown, sent to jail, he still kind of hovered over the whole enterprise, because the Beaches, Alfred and his brother Moses, they tried to solicit funding, backing, financial backing in Europe, and the problem was that once it had been exposed that New York City was the capital of corruption in the world, there wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm for throwing money at this weird little transportation project in the capital of corruption in the world. So in a way, Tweed, by reputation, continued to make it difficult for Alfred Beach to raise the money he needed. And Alfred had sunk half of his fortune into this project. And I think he realized that he didn't have enough money just on his own to do it. And without the other, you know, without outside financing, it was impossible to do. And so when he wasn't able to get that financing in 1873, 1874, the project really kind of died. They turned the tunnel became a shooting gallery for a new organization that was founded in New York, the National Rifle Association, which was founded in Manhattan, which also surprised me. But the NRA used it as a shooting gallery for a couple years, I believe, before it was finally just bricked up.
That is an all too fitting coda, honestly. Like, such an American story, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I was just going to mention that the tunnel actually survived. There was a fire in the building where the waiting room was in 1898. Alfred died in 96, and then in 98 there was a fire. So we don't know what remained of the waiting room, but whatever remained was destroyed when the building that it had been in was destroyed by fire and kind of collapsed in on itself. But when they went out and dug out the rubble, they actually found the tunnel and the car. The car was still in the tunnel at the end of the tunnel. And I have a picture of Alfred's, I believe it's his grandson, Stanley Yale Beach, sitting in the old passenger car in 1899. So it actually lasted a good while under there, hermetically sealed.
I mean, considering that we are in a New York real estate market where people are putting speakeasies in the old water towers, I can only imagine what would have happened if that had been discovered in 1998. It would have been the most desirable cocktail bar, and I'm sure that Greg and I would have been hosting parties there.
Well, you can get. I think the co-op in the building where the building burned down, as I mentioned, but the building that's there now is 258 Broadway. So maybe you can get a. I think they have a co-op in there for $1.5 million. You can get in the door.
That's my plan. Matthew, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Matthew Algeo, he is the author of New York Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach, and The Origins of Mass Transit. This has been another episode of Unfrozen.